I'm Matthew McCabe. Welcome to Miracle Voices. Each episode, we will be delving into stories of forgiveness, healing, and transformation that have come about from integrating the principles of the book, A Course in Miracles. If you want to learn more about A Course in Miracles, visit www.acim.org. If you'd like to visit the Miracle Voices site, please go to www.miraclevoices.org. If you feel inspired to make a love offering, please visit us at miraclevoices.org/donate. All donations go to support the work of the Foundation for Inner Peace, the publisher of A Course in Miracles. Now here's your program. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another edition of Miracle Voices. This is your co-host, Matt McCabe. I'm here with my co-host, Tam Morgan. Tam, how you doing today?
Well, today. How about you?
Doing well. No complaints.
Okay. Yay. That's always a big thing.
Yeah.
The Jews, we don't know that. Even with A Course in Miracles, we really don't know. No complaints.
And our guest today is Sherry Rothenberger. Sherry, welcome to Miracle Voices. How are you doing?
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm doing really good.
Okay.
Excited to be here.
Great.
And where are you joining us from in the world?
I am in Clearwater, Florida, like a little, we're kind of between Tampa, St. Pete, and Clearwater, a little unincorporated Clearwater. It's beautiful.
Oh,
beautiful,
good.
But hot and humid.
Yes.
I like that, an unincorporated Clearwater.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you don't want to be defined, that's where
right.
you live.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Great. Great. Well, Sherry, why don't you tell us how A Course in Miracles came into your life?
Well, okay. Actually, it came into my life by me giving it as a gift to someone else. I gave it as a gift to my mother, not knowing what it was, which is very strange. But my mother had, this was a long time ago, my mother had lost her job. And she was absolutely devastated. I mean, devastated in a way that I had never seen her. And it frightened me. And I was at a loss of what to do. Everything that I seemed to try to do to get her, you know, to herself, it wasn't working. So one day I was at work not too long after this happened. And we had a receptionist who was a temp that day. And we were, you know, getting everything ready to go home. And the receptionist asked me how I was. And I, for some reason, just started telling her about my mother and what was going on. And she said, oh, I've gone through something really difficult too. There's this book on cassette that you can go to the library and get. She said that it had helped her through a difficult time with her daughter. It had helped both of them. And, you know, when you're in that place where you're just desperate for help. I didn't ask any questions about what this cassette was or who this person was, nothing. I left work. I went immediately to the bookstore. And luckily it was there and I purchased it. That was when you could get, there was a whole section of cassettes, books on cassette. And I left the bookstore and I went immediately to my parents' house. And I remember saying to my mother when I handed it to her, here, this will help you. And it makes me a little bit emotional when I think about it, because obviously I didn't know what it was even, you know, but I just had this feeling like this will help you. And I'm so grateful when I think back on it that it wasn't a book, because in her state of mind, she wouldn't have read a book, but she did listen to this cassette. She started listening to it. And it really did. It was Marianne Williamson's Return to Love. And it really did help her. It didn't help in the sense that it fixed, you know, her being fired or, you know, the court case or any of the stuff like that. But what it did was it kind of recalibrated her, put her, I was going to say back to where she was, but actually no, her being fired had brought up for her all these feelings of guilt. Even though she hadn't done anything, she was feeling all this guilt, and listening to this cassette really started to put her in touch with this innocence that we all have, you know, and it was crucial at that time. So, yeah, it made such a difference for her that then I was like, okay, what is this? I'm going to go out and I'm going to get it for me and listen to it. And so I did. And I also fell in love with it and listened to it over and over again. And back then, I think Marianne had where you could get lots of different, you know, lectures or talks that she'd given on cassette. And I don't even remember how I came across all these, but I listened to that quite a bit before I actually purchased the book. And it's funny now because I remember thinking, you know, I'm from a small town in Michigan, and I remember thinking this stuff is wonderful, but there clearly there are no Course in Miracles classes in this town. You know, there aren't any in Michigan, I'm sure. You know, this was when people were just starting to get, you know, the internet in their house. So I had no idea that this whole Course in Miracles community existed out there, or that there were, in fact, classes in my little small town. There were a couple of them, which was a real surprise. But yeah, so for 28 years since I bought the book and went to my first actual class, and I absolutely love it. I mean, there's been times where I haven't loved it. You know, everybody knows that feeling. But yeah, it's definitely, it's had a huge impact on my family as a whole. And I love it.
The gift that keeps on giving.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
So when Marianne probably kept referencing A Course in Miracles and giving quotes and stuff like that, and so you're like, oh, I have to go out and get this book now. Like, it was kind of like the next step.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's funny. I was thinking about how this, you know, how I actually ended up getting the book and going to a class. My mother had several months, say 4 or 5 months after I got her the Marianne Williamson thing. She had a dream, and she called me and she said, look, I had this dream that I was in a church. And I was sitting in a pew, and I could feel this throbbing on the back of my head. And she said, I reached back, and there was this huge bald spot and this big, like, egg-shaped thing on my head. So in the dream, she said, she turned around to the person behind her in the church and said, can you look at my head and see what's happening? And the person looked, and they said, yes, you have this big, bald, throbbing, like, goose egg, and it's got writing on it. And she said, writing? And they said, yeah, it says, Margie misses you. So my mother called me. She was like, my gosh, this dream, what do you think this means? You know, who is Margie? So we went over everybody we could think of. My grandma's name is Margaret. Did anybody ever call her Margie? We couldn't think of a single thing. We kind of dropped it. And that same week, my mother found out from someone that there was a Course in Miracles meeting in the town, up in town, in a church. So my mom's, you know, on it. She called immediately to the church, and the woman who taught the class happened to answer the phone. She was, oh, yes, you know, we're doing a Course in Miracles class once a week in the church basement. We'd love to have you. She asked my mother where she was from. And when my mother told her, she said, oh, we already have a woman who comes from out there. Her name's Margie. And my mom... Yeah, I get just emotional. My mom was like, oh my gosh, this is it. You know, I'm going. So she said she went. And it's funny, but she said, you know, I went. She said, I sat right next to Margie, you know, week after week. Okay, I'm here. What's going to happen? What is it? You know, what's this amazing connection with Margie? And she said, the thing was, it turned out that Margie was just this really nice lady. There was nothing, no, you know, soulmate thing with my mom, no big connection. But she said what happened was the class was, she said it would have been over her head. She said, I had no idea what they were talking about. It just seemed so over my head. But I kept thinking, I don't care about that. I'm just here to figure out what the deal is with Margie. And she said it took her about 6 weeks of going when all of a sudden she was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And she started asking questions. And although her and Margie were friends, you know, they both agreed that it felt that was just the thing that got her to sit still long enough to make that connection, you know, to start to be able to take it in. And that teacher then, that story, that teacher, I was like, okay, I'm ready to, you know, I'm ready to get the book. Let's get into this because, yeah, I love the things that Marianne was, you know, referencing, like you said, the quotes, the concepts. But, you know, getting into it with this teacher, I remember she was on chapter 17 when I showed up to class. And so I kind of jumped in, you know, right in the middle. But it was wonderful. Yeah, absolutely lovely.
One of the things I love most about that story is that Margie was not the most powerful connection in the universe between your mom and she, you know, that it really was just a signpost that brought it further. And it wasn't reeked with specialness. It was just what it was. And, you know, in a psychological way, talking about a dream and the dream being, you know, in the subconscious, and just that the class in the of the course was at the church in the basement. They went together. Margie was in the basement of both her dream and in this world that she entered into the course. And she was just kind of the usher.
Yeah. I love that part about it. I think if it had been, I don't know, it just like you said, Tam, it was just so wonderful, you know, and for my mother to recognize that, oh, it wasn't really about Margie. It was just, the usher her in and get her to sit still. You know? Yeah. It's wonderful.
It really story. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
And well, I'd love to hear your forgiveness story.
Oh, okay. Well, it's my favorite. I have, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, so I have a lot of forgiveness stories. But this one is my favorite. I love sharing it with people because I think even if you don't have any knowledge of the course, this is a story that I always find, you know, at least for most people, it impacts them. And it started when I was 11. So it goes over a long period of time. But it first started when I was 11 years old. And I fell in love with this t-shirt. There was this like blue, kind of a deep blue t-shirt. It had white piping on the sleeves and across the front in white lettering. It said, "A perfect saint, I ain't." Mm-hmm. And, you know, at 11 years old, I love words anyway. I've always been a sucker for poems and quotes and rhymes. And I love this shirt. I just thought it was the cutest, sassiest thing. And I couldn't wait to wear it to school. And when I was wearing it, I felt confident and cute. And at 11 years old, that was not a feeling I was familiar with. I had started puberty really young. You know, like a year and a half before that, and I was in what my family referred to as a chubby stage. I felt really self-conscious, but in this t-shirt, I felt like, oh, I can't wait to wear this to school. I feel fantastic. And so I did. I wore it to school. And as I was walking to get in the lunch line, feeling so confident, I noticed the girl in front of me was someone I'd been friends with for a long time. And Tracy, and she had also started puberty like me. So we were kind of unusual, the two of us. The previous year, she'd also been going through a chubby stage. But this year, when we'd returned to school, she'd lost all the weight. So I found that I was more self-conscious around her than I was with the girls who'd always been tiny. I think I felt ashamed, you know, but just self-conscious. But on this particular day, I noticed her in the lunch line and I was feeling good. So I tapped her on the back. And when she turned around, lo and behold, she's wearing the exact same t-shirt, which I thought, here we are, you know, excited 11-year-old girl. I'm like, oh my gosh, look at us. We're wearing the same t-shirt. And she said, yeah, but it fits me. It doesn't fit you.
Oh.
And I just, you know, devastated. And by that point, I was pretty good at not showing my emotions. So I didn't cry or get angry or I'm sure that she didn't notice or anybody else noticed. But inside, I was devastated. And for some reason, that moment froze in my mind. And I think, you know, the course talks about how we gather a scrap from here, a piece from there, you know. This moment in this lunch line in that shirt, the feeling before of feeling confident, the feeling immediately afterwards, the shame, I never wore the shirt again. And it froze in my mind with all these, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, other little moments that you gather over the years. And that was that. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, I was 11, you know, it was not the worst thing that ever happened to me. But like I said, it just, you know, it wasn't something I was reviewing every day. But I think throughout the years, when I would feel confident in something, I would think, oh, I like this dress, or I like this. I'd think, you know, I'd remember that moment. You can't really trust yourself. You think you look good, but you don't, you know. So it just kind of stayed there. And then fast forward 20 years later, this same girl and I had remained friends through school and actually become closer after school. So she was in town and she was staying the weekend at my house. We were up late into the night. We were talking and she was going through something really hard in her personal life, really a difficult position she was in. And so we were up late, you know, having a glass of wine, talking it through, and she's just pouring her heart out to me, telling me every detail, every thought, every fear, every nuance. And really, at this point, she's, you know, crying, and I just feel for her so much where she's at. And she looks at me with tears in her eyes and she says, what do I do? You know, what do I do? What would you do? And I felt, you know, the pain. And at that point, I was probably been a course student for maybe 2-3 years, I'm guessing. So I answered her, what would I do? And what I said was, well, if it were me, what I would do is I would make sure, go somewhere where you know you can be alone, uninterrupted, and I would light a candle, and then I would talk to God, Jesus, Holy Spirit, whatever you're comfortable with. And I would say everything you just said to me. Don't hold anything back. Just let her rip. Every feeling, every thought, every worry, every everything. Just every bit of it that you just told me. Let it rip. And then ask for guidance. And I knew she wasn't a Course in Miracles student, but I figured she'd grown up going to church. You know, I assumed it was something she was, you know, she was used to praying. Something. It wouldn't be that big of a leap to say something like that. But when I saw the look on her face, you'd have thought I told her to light herself on fire. It was just this look of shock and horror. And her eyes were big and her mouth. But what she said to me was, do you remember the matching t-shirts we had that day in the lunch line? And I thought, what? I remember, but why are we talking about this? She said, do you remember how it fit me and it didn't fit you? And honestly, in my mind, I was thinking like, well, you don't have to be mean. What are we bringing this up for? And then all of a sudden, I heard her instead of me. I heard her. And she said, you can go to God. It didn't fit you. It fit me. I've never been a good girl, but you are. You can go to God. I can't. And it always chokes me up because I had no idea. And my concept of her has always been a good girl. I mean, she was a straight A student. She was in band. She was just a sweet, good girl. So it never occurred to me that she felt that way about herself. It never occurred to me that she would think she couldn't talk to God. But also I was stunned because I think we had a lot of miracles that night. We really, you know, dug into her talking about God and innocence and all that kind of stuff. But I couldn't get over that here was this moment that was frozen in my mind, and she remembered it too, word for word. It meant something completely different. And I was 100% sure I knew what it meant. When she said, it fits me, it doesn't fit you, if someone would have said to me, well, yeah, but maybe she meant something else, there was no conceivable thing that it could have meant to me. And now when I tell people the story, I think, well, it's really easy to think it meant I'm not a perfect saint. It's equal option. But in my mind at that time at 11 years old, and actually for all those 20 years after, it never occurred to me, was there another meaning? Was there another way to look at it? And so that later that night and then the next day, I just kept thinking, wait a minute. I was 100% sure. There was no wiggle room in my mind. 100% sure that I knew what happened. I knew what it meant. But I was wrong. And then my mind started to, what if I was wrong about some of these other hundreds or thousands of little moments that are in my mind? What if 12% of them or 20% or 50%? Then I thought, holy shit, what if all of them? What if I'm wrong about all of them? Even if that's what she'd meant, still the meaning that I gave it, and it kind of blew things open for me. It was such a moment of, not even a moment, just like waves of, oh my gosh. And I started to understand, you know, things about the course that hadn't really landed yet. I remember my course teacher saying that sometimes when you read something in the course or you're in a class and somebody shares something and it doesn't land, like you'll say, like, I just can't get it. It just doesn't make sense to me. I can't get it. And she would always say, well, that doesn't matter, honey. It's held in trust. It's given to you and it's held in trust. And when you're ready to receive it, it just drops in. And that's what I felt like in that moment. And I've had lots of moments since then. Sometimes things that were said 15 years earlier, and then I'm like, oh, that's what the course means when it says that. Now I get it. It was held in trust. I love that idea. But that's what I realized, like, oh, projection makes perception. The world you see is what you gave it. We both had that moment, and we both held it in our mind, what happened, what we were wearing, what we said. And it meant entirely different things to each of us. And her perception of her as not a good girl was a belief she had. And my perception of me as not pretty enough, overweight, less than, was my. So it was just such a forgiveness story for me, not in forgiving her, but in starting to forgive myself for the meaning that I had given things and realizing how I held on to these little scraps that supported the stories. You know, it's not like I had this awareness and then just let them all go, but I could really start to see, like, oh, wow, I really do give everything all the meaning it has. You know, I'm seeing that way. So,
and yeah, what's so beautiful about it too is talk about getting to the core of forgiveness. It never really happened.
Right.
That's right. You know, like everything you thought about it never really happened. I'm curious, did you share it with her?
I did. And you know what's funny is that when I first shared it with her, she's such a sweetheart. And I first shared it with her, she kept apologizing. I'm so sorry. And I'm like, honey, you didn't do anything. That's the beauty of it. You didn't do anything. There's nothing to apologize for. And she was here last year visiting, and her and another friend of mine. And I was like, oh, something happened. And I was like, oh, it's our story. So now we both refer to it as our story, because there's so many times where you can use it again, you know, where someone will say this thing happened and I felt, you know, this happened and here's what they said. And I felt devastated. And I think sometimes I can be annoying to people because someone will say something to me. So-and-so said this. And I'm like, is there anything else it could have meant? People are like, stop. Seriously, you know, trust me.
I definitely, if you don't mind, I'm going to jump in and share.
Oh no, I love it.
Kind of story that this brings up too. But one, I just want to say that one of the things I was impressed with in what you were speaking about was also that there is that you were friends with her. Like you didn't, said this thing that to you was absolutely at that age, a devastating comment. Like, you know, that you never, some people would never speak to that person again or would shrink away completely. But you still stayed friends for all those years to even double back on it. I love that part of it because it shows your own nature. And even though you felt and harbored this, it was against you and not against her for saying it to you, which is really beautiful. And before I forget, something else came back about the Margie story about I suddenly remembered the meaning of Margie is pearl. And so in a dream, if you dream of a Margie, you're dreaming of a pearl of wisdom.
Oh, I love that.
And also, like in Hinduism, the blue pearl is representative of the true self.
Mm.
And so, Margie, I just wanted to go back before I forgot.
I'll have to tell my mother. I love that.
I'm very nonlinear, but she was the pearl for that dream and that.
Oh, she was. Experience. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Anyway, so I'm going to try and make this super quick because this isn't about me, but it is here. I had a friend who I made when I was traveling in Nepal, and we were really good friends, and we had this wonderful traveling romance when I was in my early twenties. And we both agreed it wasn't going to work back in the States. You know, he was in Seattle, I was in New York, and I had a boyfriend and he had a girlfriend back home. And he got home and he wrote me that he broke up with his girlfriend because he wanted to be with me. And I was really upset about it. And I was like, no, no, that wasn't our plan. No, thank you. And he ended up getting the letter, getting upset, having sex with his girlfriend, getting her pregnant, and they got married. And she always held a deep resentment towards me for getting her pregnant. But I came through town into Seattle and I visited them. And the first thing she said when she saw me, because I'm very petite, and she goes, oh, you're not nearly as threatening as I thought you would be, meaning I wasn't as attractive, all those things. Anyway, years went by. He got cancer, got leukemia, and I helped him. He come to California, and you know, my mother and I gave him all these books for healing and blah blah blah. And it was he went into remission, and it was a really great thing for him. Then he went out of remission, and I heard he was getting a transfusion, a bone marrow transfusion from his brother. And I called him. Now this is about 35 years after we knew each other first. We didn't see each other much at all, but there was kindness and love between us. Mm-hmm. And I called him to wish him good luck. And he answered the phone in the hospital. And he said, hi, my wife is here. And I have to tell you, I made an agreement with her that I would never speak to you again.
Oh, wow.
And I was blown away. It's like, what? And he said, yes, for her to stay with me through this next phase, because she's been with me through so much. And they had another kid and a happy life, so I thought. She said, I must never speak to you. So he said, so, and he really articulated, I am not going to speak to you for as long as I live. And I said, well, okay. I was stunned. I hung up. I sent him love, all the love in the world. And then I wondered, oh, that can't be true. We have such a deep old connection. That can't be true. He's going to call me on the sly. But it didn't happen. And 3 years went by. And I finally was just really hurt and angry. And it's like, really? But I also understood, but I couldn't imagine someone holding a grudge for me for that long over something that I didn't even do in my mind. You know, Anyway, so 3 years went by and I finally decided he was well known in the field of advertising. And I decided to look him up and see just how he was doing and his family. Well, it ended up he died that day that he spoke to me. And his message that he kept repeating is, I can't. And he had a tremendous sense of humor. I can't speak to you for the rest of my life. I can't speak to you for as long as I live, which was about another 2 hours. And the healing that came into me in a similar way of how I took that statement, not as a funny message from him in a certain way, but all of this hurt and everything just reminded me of that and how we project whatever we want into something. And it might have been his greatest humorous gift because he really didn't know if he would live.
Right. Isn't that something?
Yeah. And it was his way too, in total kindness, of protecting his wife from me showing up at the funeral. Because there's no way I would have gone to that funeral or had we been in touch, had I called and said, how did it go? Yeah. I would have gone up to the funeral. And that was his kindness to her.
Aww.
So we just don't know. The Course says it. There's a lesson about it. We do not know what anything is for. We don't even know what anything is. In fact, we just don't know anything.
Boy, isn't that true? Oh, well, yeah. Thank you for sharing that.
Oh, yeah. Of course. Except to love, we do know we're given that truth, love. That's our guidance.
Yeah. I think sometimes when I think of that story with my friend, I wonder if in the same way that Margie was used to get my mother to that church, to that class, I wonder if that incident in the lunch line with the t-shirts and that wasn't so that we would have this miracle later. You know, we would have this because both of us have, you know, she's not a course student, but I think it's still impacted her and so many people that we've shared it with. And I think had that not happened in that lunch line, you know, we wouldn't have had this awareness of, oh, wow, you know, I've given everything all the meaning it has for me. So it really felt to me like it was all meant to be. It was, you know, meant for me to feel hurt, meant for me to hold on to it, meant for me to see later that I was wrong, you know.
Yeah. I believe that completely. I believe we enter each other's lives with even pre-written contracts to give each other the lessons that we need to learn.
Yeah.
And what resonated with me, Sherry, was when you said that later on after that event, when you felt pretty, you kind of flashbacked, you boomerang back to that moment where you're like, oh, of course it doesn't fit me. I'm not pretty. I can't feel pretty in this. And it's like this lens of how you see yourself from this little comment kind of comes back like a bird on your shoulder and like, remember, you can't look pretty, Sherry.
Yeah.
And it's like, and then when that belief system kind of gets shattered, it's like, oh, I have to reindex all my beliefs about this because it was a daisy chain that was a fiction.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's interesting too, because I was thinking about sharing this and this story on here. And I had, I think it's, you know, the amazing thing about being a course student, like where the healing can come in your life and where you kind of like hold it off. And I was thinking, I had such a takeaway from that experience with her of saying like, wow, I give everything all the meaning it has. And so I question when someone says something to me, you know, am I understanding it right? Am I, you know, am I giving it meaning? And like I said, I won't say to other people a lot, but I realized as I was thinking about the story, that, oh my gosh, yeah, that's what it did was it, one of the things was to question that thing. If I feel confident in something, if I feel good, I, you know, was looking for someone else. And I thought, you know what? Sad to say, I still do that. I received the miracle from, or the forgiveness, the miracle from recognizing that, oh my gosh, I give everything all the meaning it has. But I don't think I took that step to go back and say that idea that I held, that I need other people's approval, that I, you know, how I see myself is reflected through other. I don't think I took it all the way and used it to question that, to go to that core thing, because I still catch myself doing that, you know, asking my husband, well, like, how does this look on me? And if he doesn't like it, or is like, eh, it's okay, I'm still struggling with, oh yeah, I can't really trust myself. So it's funny how I think I got the big picture of giving everything the meaning it has, but not necessarily still doing that. There's more healing work to do on that core idea, you know?
Yeah, that's it. It's particularly tough. And I don't know if this is true, but it seems to be particularly tough for women, especially in partnerships, because there are things that I really do love to wear, but if my partner doesn't care for it, he has to look at me. So I think, okay, I'll do this for him, but I will still get it to wear elsewhere. And the learning, the complete learning that it's about what makes you feel good in you and not anyone else's eyes. And everyone can think I look ridiculous in something, and I might even look ridiculous in something. But if I'm feeling good, I'm going to rock ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it's taken me a long time to get to that. Yeah. But yeah, like just rock what you like about something and other people's perceptions, that's theirs. And, you know, they can't take away your joy unless you let them.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Diedrich Wolsek has that 6 steps to forgiveness that he does. And, you know, the one of the steps is it's about me. And then, you know, this feeling that I'm having, have I felt this before? And as you go through the things, you get to, you know, the core belief that you're working with is that it's not true. And I think for me, this idea of being chubby or not being thin enough or whatever is a like a foundational thing. When I was young and I was feeling that I didn't have my father's affections, my little girl mind tried to make a story of what that was.
Yeah,
that's what it landed on. I'm not, you know, he adores my mother. I mean, so I'm making these assumptions, and that right there, you know, it's one of the things I love about the course. And it's one of the things that's challenging is because you really, you know, to apply it to everything, you know, and to go to that thing of it's not true. And, you know, this is a story that I made up. This is meaning that I gave, and I'm going to keep experiencing it here or there until I can get to, you know, it's not true.
Yeah.
I made it up.
And then what is true?
Yeah. Yeah.
Back to the love. You know, I will share with you that, you know, I always am uncomfortable or have been very much more in the past than now, but with people projecting onto me as a guru and, you know, or a teacher or a saint, because I'm just carrying, stewarding the course. And it has nothing to do with me, but there's so many people, like it used to be, can I touch you? You're related to your mother. And now it's, can I touch you? You're you. And I shrank from it so much. And I have a notebook that I carry with me to most meetings and everything, of a picture of a woman meditating. And it says on the top, I ain't no saint.
Oh,
and it's my favorite notebook. Oh, and it makes me smile. And it's a cross between you and your friend in a certain way, because I don't want to be seen as a saint. I just want to walk through with love as I can. And yet, what is our determination of what is a saint? Yeah. It's just, you know, committed to walking in love. Even Mother Teresa's journal before she passed was a major crisis in faith, you know, still human, still human.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the things that I've loved about the course, because I've, like I said, there were times where, you know, I'm sure we all go through this if we stick with the course, like 5 years into it, where I thought, like, I really know this course, you know, and then we hit something really difficult in life. And I felt like, well, the course is not there for me in the way that I need it to be. And I kind of put it down for a bit. And then when I came back to it, I was like, oh, there's so much more depth to it. I had no idea, you know? And then again, you know, for a very, like, I felt like I took a deep dive into it. And then I would have a point where I'm like, oh, I think I've taken it as far as it'll go. You know, I've taken it as far as it goes. I need to move on to other things. And, you know, and of course the course says at the end, you know, forget this course, forget this book, and come with empty hands under your God. It does say that, but what I found for me anyway is that there are times where I'm not in it, you know, I'm not reading from it, and then it comes again. And when I go back to it, there's a depth that I'm still getting out my old book and going, no, they put this this lesson was not here, you know. And it's just a gift that keeps on giving, and it, I'm so grateful for it, you know. And I don't think, like you said, I don't think like, oh, I'm A Course in Miracles. I remember Marianne Williamson saying, you know, people wanted to pour pink paint over things like, I'm A Course in Miracles student. I don't get angry. You know, I get angry. I get jealous. I get, you know, like, I know I'm in my wrong mind pretty quickly when I'm doing it. But yeah, it's still, you know, no, I am not a perfect saint.
No, here's to that.
Yeah.
What a wonderful forgiveness story. And it seems like it's such a small thing, but it's got to be one of the best examples I've ever heard of a perception and a belief that kind of create this total opportunity to see things differently and to realize, like, wait a second, I don't know what do I know? I think I know, but what's that based on? So wonderful, wonderful story, Sherry.
Thank you.
What do you do when you get caught in an ego storm or ego attack and you get, you know, pushed out of your center of peace and it feels very real and there's judgment, anger, reaction, blame, projection, denial, all the fun stuff the ego offers. What do you do in those moments to try to get recentered?
Well, I think it depends on the moment. One of the things that I know I've heard some people that say when they're getting that, they don't want to talk about the course or talk about these ideas. My first thing is, please, somebody talk course to me, you know, talk love to me. If I can, you know, I'm lucky enough to still have my mother. If I can get to somebody who does the course and knows it, that's my very first choice. Just keep talking the course to me until I'm sane again. You know, remind me the things. I used to get so mad when my mom and I were first doing the course together, and I would be saying, complaining of something, and I would say to her, and she'd say, well, have you asked? And I remember one day saying to her, have I asked? What am I, a freaking idiot? I have to ask on everything. And then later, of course, you know, years later, I was like, oh, please, you know, when the question comes, would you rather be right or happy, or, you know, you don't want to be wrong. I'm at a point now where I'm like, if I'm upset, my first thought is, please, God, let me be stupid wrong, not just a little wrong, but because what I'm believing when I'm upset, I'm in an ego storm, what I'm believing hurts like hell. You know, I feel unsafe. I feel unloved. I feel victimized or whatever. And when I'm in that, my thought is, please let me be stupid wrong, not just a little. I mean, I remember when I didn't want to be wrong, you know, but I want to be so wrong so that this, you know, is what I'm believing is not true. So that's my first thing is, please, somebody talk truth to me. get me back to a sane way of thinking. But there are times where whatever is going on, I think it's the things that have really deep hooks into that childhood stuff, you know, those early beliefs. And I didn't used to do this, but I find it really helpful if I can... I like to go off by myself if I'm going to do this, but it doesn't always work this way. Last time I did it in front of my husband, but I let it out. Kind of like what I said to my friend that time, you know, like, let her rip. I mean, I say every fear that I have, and I say it out loud. You know, I'm mad about this. I'm hurt about this. I don't feel safe. I feel, you know, I swear if I want to swear, whatever it is, it's like it comes from the bottom, you know, like my gut right up through the top of me. And it feels like it comes right about the top of my head. Just let it all out. And once it's out, then I guess the energy is out. And then I can think clearly again. I remember a teacher years ago, he wasn't a course teacher. He was actually somebody I had a really hard relationship with. But he said to me one time, I'll never forget, say it out loud, whatever you're thinking, because you could see by my face. And he said, Sherry, say it out loud, because until you say it out loud, you're not going to realize how ridiculous what you're believing is. And he was right. I thought, oh my gosh, there's been so many times since then where I can have a story going in my head. I've got complete buy-in. But if I say it out loud, even if I'm just in a room by myself, I don't know, your conscious mind hears it, I'm not sure, but I hear it and I'm like, that's not true. That can't possibly be true. But left alone in my mind, it feels so real. So like I said, if I'm really, really triggered in and I can't get out of it by talking the course with people, that's my thing. I let it, all the ugliness, all the fear, all the hate, all the everything out. and it releases the energy. And I also see, I see the falseness of what I'm believing in. And then that, you know, the line from the course, I must have decided wrongly because I'm not at peace. I think for years I thought of that as I've decided wrongly. Let's say I'm upset with someone, you know, let's say I'm upset with my husband. And I say, well, I must have decided wrongly. I saw it as, oh, so he's right and I'm wrong. You know, I've got to accept that he's right and I'm wrong. And then at some point it dropped in. Oh, it's saying the decision to not be at peace. Anytime I'm not at peace, I'm making the wrong decision, not about the circumstances. The circumstances really don't even matter. It's just that I'm believing that there's something happening that makes me not safe or not loved, or that's the wrong decision. So I started to think of it as, if I were in my right mind, I'd always be at peace. When I'm in my right mind, peace is the only perception. So clearly I'm thinking something God would not have me think. And that's kind of the process I think I go through. You know, like I said, I don't want to pour pink paint over it. And not that I haven't tried. Lord knows I tried it every way possible, because I have that whole, you know, I'm when you've got fight, flight, fawn, and forget what the other one is, flee. I was, a codependent fawner for years. So, you know, I remember one time things were really uncomfortable at my house at the dinner table. And I remember saying out loud, quick, somebody tell somebody they're beautiful. Make this stop. I have a real tendency to want to fawn or pour pink paint. But I've really worked on, especially in the last few years, really worked on being able to center into the truth and let things work through me if they have to work through me, and being honest with people, you know, not honest because my feelings are the truth, but sometimes being able to in a say that I'm upset if I'm upset, you know, even though sometimes I'll say, you know, I'm upset and I realize that I'm probably giving this meaning it doesn't have. So help me to look at this with you, you know, so I'll throw anything at it, anything but the kitchen sink. But yeah, those are pretty much my, I don't want to be upset. I don't like being out of my peace. And, but it happens. It happens regularly. And, but I think it's like when I was in my 20s, I went through a lot of depression. And I remember when depression would be coming on, I could feel it coming. And it was scary because it would go so deep and it would last for so long. And I think I can't do anything to stop this. You know, I don't know how to stop it. And I know how bad it's going to get and how deep it's going to be and how long it takes to get out of it. And over time with doing the course, I don't really go through depression at all anymore. I mean, I definitely don't, but what happened was it didn't just stop, but it was longer periods of time between getting depressed. And then when it did happen, it wouldn't go as deep. It wouldn't last as long. And then it just kept getting further and further until I didn't suffer from depression anymore. And I feel like that's kind of how ego storms are for me. Not that they don't happen, but they don't go as deep. They don't last as long. It's that. That's thank my experience.
Yeah.
Okay. And now we're on to
yes. Vegan. That's right. Sherry, what is your favorite comfort food?
My favorite comfort food. Lately it has been, which is odd. Lately it has been sweet potato casserole.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah. I know that for some people it's just a seasonal thing, but it's been a big deal going on for me. It's my mother-in-law's recipe. My mother-in-law is not with us anymore, but I modify it a lot because, you know, I'm always trying to make healthy decisions. And that thing was loaded with butter and loaded with sugar. And so I keep trying to tweak that recipe to get the still get that creamy smoothness, you know, that mouth feel. It's delicious.
Pecans on top?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Mm. Pecans on
I
top.
Know this yeah. dish. I'm a little too familiar with her. It's my goat on Thanksgiving. It's like a beeline right to that.
Yeah. I make it, I think in the last 2 months, I've made it like 3 times. And honestly, I eat it for breakfast. You know, like I said, I've made a healthier version, you know, but I've played around with it. But oh my gosh, I love it. And I like it cold. So.
That's a brilliant move to have that for breakfast. Yeah. This is rocking my world. I'm going to have to change my perception of what's possible with sweet potato casserole.
Yeah. Yeah. Love I know it. People are like that with pumpkin. They're like, oh, pumpkin. You're one of those. I'm like, oh no, I love pumpkin, but I love pumpkin all year round. I don't want any pumpkin spice coffee. No, I don't want that. But as far as pumpkin, I mix that in with my yogurt. I love pumpkin.
Mm.
Goodness.
Thank you.
That was a very satisfying answer, Sherry. Both the pumpkin and the sweet potato casserole. Okay. Sherry, thanks so much for coming on Miracle Voices and sharing your miracle voice. Is there any place you want to point listeners, Facebook, anything, or do you just want to go back to your normal life and not be contacted?
I don't have any websites or anything, but I am on Facebook. And my email is my name, Sherry Rothenberger at Yahoo. I can be contacted by anybody. I'm totally open to that.
Wonderful.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it. It was wonderful talking with both of you. And I love this podcast. Love it.
Oh, thank you. Thanks, Sherry. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for listening today. Please subscribe to Miracle Voices by hitting the subscribe button on your podcast app. If you are enjoying these conversations, please consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever podcast app you use. And lastly, please visit us at miraclevoices.org and join our newsletter so we can stay connected. Until the next podcast, I want to leave you with my favorite course quote, "When you want only love, you will see nothing else."